Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Hey, I'm Bella. I'm an alcoholic.
Bella.
Oh, I'm super nervous to speak this meeting. I think this is the biggest meeting I've ever spoke before. But I'm excited to be here tonight. I don't come to double speaker a lot, so it's exciting to be here. I guess I'll start off with like a little background about me. I grew up in an alcoholic household. Both my parents are alcoholics. My sister's an alcoholic. And the apple didn't fall too far from the fucking tree. And I started drinking when I was 14. I went through weird shit, you know, like traumatic stuff happened, ended up getting raped, like just shit along the lines of just like not normal, like what happens to normal people when they drink. And that's what kind of brought me into the rooms of AA. I got directed here by my therapist. This is not my first sobriety date. And this is the first time I've pretty much worked the program, like, and actually given myself to the program. And it's the longest run I've had so far at sobriety with working the steps. And it's been pretty awesome sometimes. It sucks. It sucks better sober, which is like, it sucks, but it doesn't suck like as much. But yeah, I came back into the program around this time last year. So I'm coming up on a year right now. And God willing. But I actually, so yesterday would be mark 1 year of, I texted my sponsor. I went to CDRP, hella shit. Like, you know, I tried to do like pretty much what a lot of young people do when they try to get sober. I'm only 19. And it just didn't work for me. Like nothing was really substantial enough until like I really like came. I had to hit a bottom that was substantial enough for me. And when I hit that, I was sitting at fucking Fruitvale Bar. I was dope sick. I was hungover. I didn't like know what to do. I was broken. And I texted my old sponsor and I was like, I'm ready to come back. And even when I did that, it took me a while to really get back into the rooms. And, you know, like this past year has been crazy, like working the steps, like it's truly changed my life. Like when I first came in, like I was really standoffish. I was mean. I was a bitch. I was mean. I thought I was better than pretty much everybody in here. I don't really think that I was convinced I was an alcoholic, but not to the extent of like how fucked up like a majority of the people are in here. But yeah. I'm still a fucking alcoholic. Like, but I thought I was better than everybody else. And, you know, working the steps like has really humbled me, and like seeing my part in shit, like it's made me a better person and I can function. Like when I came in, I was not a woman of integrity, which is what I hold myself to today. And, you know, like this year, I've been through a lot in this past year. You know, I lost one of my best friends. She was shot in the head and I dealt with that at 4 months sober. And she left behind my godson. She had a son who was 5 months old at the time. And I pretty much take care of a baby now that's, he just turned one, which is really exciting. And it's like amazing. Like I've gotten like responsibilities like this sober. Like I have people that trust me. Like I'm allowed to be around a baby, which is like pretty awesome. I just bought him like this super dope wagon. It was really cool. But I have people that trust me. I have friends. I'm really like, I get to travel. This is blessings of sobriety, but definitely like my biggest blessing is that I'm fucking sober. And I get to function like pretty much like a normal member of society nowadays, and that I don't have to validate myself using drugs or alcohol. I don't have to fill the void and destroy myself anymore in the process. I can fill the void with this program, which is something that I'm still learning how to do. And it's not always like what I want, because I want instant gratification, but it's substantial enough that I feel okay. So Yeah, that's pretty much like it. Just stay around, like work the steps. Like it's been hard getting sober, especially at a young age, because it's a lot different than what other people do who are my age. And I'm from Oakland. I'm really from the town. So you feel me? I like to party, but I like to go to bailes and quinces and baptisms and like all this shit. And I can still do this, but I'm sober now. So it just like it sucks better sober. I guess that's what I'll end it with. Thank you.
Okay, what did you call this? The weird little contraption?
I didn't call it.
You called it something really good. I can't remember what it was. This shitty little thing or something like that.
Oh,
hi, I'm Grant. I'm an alcoholic. God, I really thought you guys were going to be away somewhere for Thanksgiving. So this is rather difficult. I think I spoke here 5 years ago, and I think it's going to be a little different now because I've lived a little longer. I got 26 years November 1st, and that was weird, and it's in spite of my best efforts, and it's not because I'm Mr. Awesome AA Dude, and it's not because I'm a big book thumper and I jam my finger in people's sternums. I don't do any of that. I've gone decades being a self-pitying hipster, you know, and just not calling my sponsor until I was ready to blow my brains out. And I can't really explain this. It's just kind of how it is. Grace kind of happens when you don't deserve it. And I'm from that great big edifice across the bay over there, San Francisco. I was born there. Damn it. In the mid-60s, which is a long, long time ago, and there was a lot going on then. My brother was running away and doing acid in the hate. He would come home on mushrooms, and I was like 4 at the time. And he'd take mushrooms, and he realized how much he loved us, and he missed us on mushrooms. And so my parents would show him how much they loved and missed him by trying to have him arrested. And so there would be these scuffles at night, you know, and things were broken. I'd come out the next day, and stuff was broken, and the banister was broken, you know, because my brother had been hauled off. My mom was a vodka-drinking, postpartum, depressed person. And stayed that way until about 10 years ago. I don't really remember a lot of good information from my mom, except when Janis Joplin died and she screamed at me. Because Janis Joplin had died. And so really the only good information I got was, you know, my mom saying, if somebody offers you drugs, don't do it. And I'm 5. And so that didn't work. My dad was your typical emotionally constipated 50s guy who wanted to the only way he could really express himself was by drinking brandy. Had to be a certain kind. And he liked to put an air of refinement on it, but it was Canadian Club. I mean, come on. And he would say, you know, bring me 2 fingers and my favorite snifter, you know. And it's like, yeah, I got 2 fingers in your snifter. And then he would sit there and he would start to gush. And he would tell me how much he loved my mom's mother. And admired her so much, and then he'd start to cry, and then he'd recite If by Rudyard Kipling, and then he'd start looking for his copy of the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam, and I was like, I'm not going to be like you, I'm not going to, you know, no, I was having a lot of trouble dealing with people from a very early age. I went to this Montessori school, and we were all trying to be very groovy. And I remember deciding at a certain point, very young, this was my first major decision in life, was that if I held on to a lie long enough and just kept doing it until the other person got exhausted or fell asleep, that meant I won. And so I went and I tried it on a preschooler, and it worked. I told him his mom was his dad, or I told him, you know, the sky was purple, and I just kept doing it until he cried, and I was like, it works. And so that was my recipe for human communication for the next 15 years. And people, you know, I call it now the other people problem. It's other people were a big problem. They had things I needed, but they were scary, and I didn't know how to deal with them, and I didn't know how to talk to them, and I didn't know how to be understood by them. So I had serious problems. And by the time I got to junior high, I was completely neurotic and terrified, and went to a public junior high from a hippie Montessori school, which is like putting a big sign on yourself that says, kick my ass right now. And so I was getting my ass kicked a lot. And then my friend came over and we started raiding the liquor cabinet. And it was like a switch got flicked. It was like the secret missing part of my brain got put back in. And I felt like I just felt normal suddenly. I felt like everything was okay. Like I was okay, and I'm funny, and you're funny, and this is great, and this is all funny. And it was a wonderful moment for 10 minutes. And then I ended up hallucinating and having death hallucinations and being found naked in my parents' bed. And swearing I would never do that again, which I did the next week. And so off to a really illustrious career of home drinking, which is mostly what I did. I was a home chemist. After about 10 years here, I was wondering aloud, you know, did I drink enough to come to Alcoholics Anonymous? Really, you know, I'm really kind of a panty waste. And somebody said, Gren, you drank rubbing alcohol. Shut up. Sit down. Because that's what, you know, I used to make screwdrivers out of rubbing alcohol. I used to drink cough syrup. Anything that involved not going out. You know, so going out was scary. But I knew this was how I wanted to feel. This was a way to feel how I wanted to feel. My brief moments of social drinking were people trying to deal with me sober and failing. And, you know, the word around the party was, okay, Gren is talking about the Spanish Civil War again. Can we get some beers over here? Can we, like, deal with this guy because he's really bumming us out? And so people would, you know, ply me with drink. And that was fun. But it, you know, never lasted. It was never, like, a really long-lasting thing. And pretty soon I'm crying and throwing up on people and nobody's happy. But, you know, I'm happy and I don't remember it anyway. Not a whole lot of drinking, but that was what I wanted. That was the way I wanted to drink. I wanted to, you know, I didn't want to socially drink with anybody. I wanted to drink. I wanted to get really drunk. And I wanted to die young because Reagan was president and we were all going to die anyway. And so I wanted to be sure that I died young and that we would, and I would leave this really tragically short body of poetry behind and people would be really sorry that I died. They would look, you know, they'd look at this beautiful poetry and they'd think, oh wow. Reagan killed him. Oh man, this is terrible. He was a beautiful, beautiful guy. Wow, it's terrible. So I was running with people in the 80s in San Francisco, 1983, 84 in San Francisco. We called it Summer of Speed. There was a lot of bad stuff going on. Oh God, we were all hallucinating and we were all picking spiders out of our hair. And I was dating some particularly crazy person who I moved into my parents' house. And don't ever do that. Don't do that. And she was completely tweaked and wrote a really long novel about me in my old room. Sold that house. It's great. But it bled through everything. It bled through wallpaper. Anything we tried to put on it in the years after. But she was like, you know, she would be tweaking and telling me all these things about myself and telling me that I was a terrible liar and that I had killed Crazy Horse. I'd done a lot of really bad things in previous lives. And I just sat there, you know, going, you know, I believed all of it. And by the time she was done with me, I was like a collapsed building. It was, you know, I didn't have any friends because she told me they were all evil. And I was back at my parents' house, and my parents really wanted me to fuck off at that point. And so I did what any red-blooded American boy would do. I moved into a vegan commune. And I'm sorry I didn't mention that. There are vegan communes in my story. I'm sorry if that... you know, we all get here in different ways, and we all have different ways. But there's... but those guys, those people... those incredible, like, Jewish lefties from the East Coast who proceeded to kick my ass up and down the block. And I remember this Irving, he's not that tall, you know, and he would just wag his finger at me and say, Gren, we're going to make you adhere not just to the spirit, but the letter of the law. And they would tell me to do things, really outlandish things, like go to bed at a certain time, make your bed, comb your hair, chew your food before you swallow it. Why don't you take a bath every so often, asshole? What, you know, just really, you know, they were really interfering with my whole lifestyle. And I'm just hanging out here until I get that rejection letter from UC Santa Cruz. So, you know, just give me a break here, guys. But, I tried to live a double life in the vegan commune, and I tried to, you know, I would turn compost and be a model communard by day, and then I'd go to bed and I'd think about 16th Street and the bars on 16th Street and how I hadn't really drunk in bars very much, and you know, and it didn't quite work last time. I was sitting in the bar and I was looking at that cute girl and looking at her and looking at her, and she finally came up to me and said, "Are you okay?" So I wasn't really doing too well at, you know, the social drinking, but I thought I just needed more practice. And there was this big lesbian biker chick who was like, I really thought I had a fighting chance with her, you know. She'd had a bad motorcycle accident, had all kinds of orthopedic troubles, her gallbladder was missing. She was on all kinds of pain meds, and she'd sit at the bar and go, "Fuck." And I thought she was dreamy. I really did. I thought that she was it, and, you know, she was going to be my ticket out of this compost turning thing, and it was going to be great. And she finally picked a fight with a bartender that I got involved in because I'm Sir Galahad, right? And I came back to the commune with like a black eye. And so they took my key away. So that meant I couldn't go out. And that was really weird. And since then, I've talked to people who went to treatment programs where they were kind of on lockdown. They had mutual criticisms too, where they'd sit you in this room and they'd all go around in a circle and say, "Well, I think Gren should..." And it was a lot like Walden House and other places that I've heard, you know, they pretty much did that to me. They kind of geared it all up and they did that to me. And nothing else would have worked. I needed to be just kind of smashed down and made to not go anywhere for a minute. And that's what they did. So I ended up with a little bit of time under my belt and decided that I was a great communard and the commune is great and I'm really cool and people who aren't in communes are stupid and I'm really awesome. And I did that for about 2 years until I ended up drinking vanilla extract in their larder one day. So it didn't quite work. Something was missing. And the day after I drank vanilla extract, it was shortly after the earthquake of 89. And when I'd watched the whole, you know, library just go smash and nearly died in the building. And I'm outside in this, you know, lovely picturesque garden trying to destroy the grape arbor and screaming, "I want to die, I want to die." And so they decided that I needed a break, maybe. And they put me on a green tortoise bus to Seattle. Right. Green Tortoise?
Yeah, definitely. Ooh,
yeah, good times on Green Tortoise. And I met this girl on Green Tortoise. And she said she was an alcoholic, and I said, really? So am I. And she said, I'm in recovery, and I said, so am I. And my last drink had been 10 days previous, I think. But what I was amazed about was, you know, she said, well, are you doing anything for that? And I said, no, I'm good. She said, good. And she didn't go after me at all about it. You know, she was just like, oh, you're sober, and that's great. So when I finally pissed off my grandparents in Oregon, and they wanted to put me on a bus anywhere, I had them put me on a bus to Seattle to hang out with this girl, and have her take me to a meeting, because I was curious. You know, she said, I'm going to a meeting tonight. I said, yeah, I'll go to one of those meetings. And so I went to this, the young people's meeting in the U District. I think it's still there in Seattle. And somebody, was there talking about, I listened to everybody talking, and I thought, I know what happened. You called these people, didn't you? You called them, and you told them what to say, because they're all talking about me. That's what's going on, right? Is that what you did? I know. Because somebody got up there, and he started talking about being locked in a cabin in Alaska for a year. And he said, you know, it's great. I didn't drink, but I was a miserable sack of shit. And I knew exactly what he was talking about. You know, took the drink away, and I just couldn't deal. I couldn't really deal with life and people and stuff. I was just massively unhappy. And then other people shared about, like, almost buying a car, and then they would cry. And I thought, I kind of relate to this. I really relate to these people, you know. I realized I'd kind of found the people who speak the particular kind of Martian I speak. So I went back to San Francisco and, started going to the high noon meetings there, where they tried to, you know, they tried to get me to come out for coffee, and I was like, no, I'm not going to have coffee with you. I tried to ask somebody where the bathroom was, and he said, sure, I'll be your sponsor. damn it. And these people, I mean, this was just as, like, AIDS was starting to hit in San Francisco. So a lot of these people died. They were amazing. These people just just laid it down for me. And, you know, just got me going to meetings. Got me, you know, said, go to these meetings. You need fattening up. You know, there's better snacks at these meetings. And they just kept reeling me in. And, God, it's been a long time. And, I guess really, what they really impressed on me was that, you know, this is about freedom. I mean, I got out of the commune about 6 months after I started going to meetings, because it just wasn't compatible, because the commune, was all about, you know, we're going to get into your shit, because we love you. And AA was like, how are you doing working on your shit? That's good. That's cool. All right. You know, are you not? Okay, great. Are you here? That's fine. And there was nobody really wanted to get in my shit about anything, and nobody was telling me what to do. And it worked. It was the only thing that worked. And I tried a lot of things before the commune. I tried summoning archangels. I tried, locking myself away. I tried everything they talk about in that bit that they read in the beginning of this meeting. And none of it had worked, because I just couldn't imagine not drinking. But when I was with you guys, I could imagine not drinking. I could imagine kind of getting on with things. It all seemed possible somehow. And so, you know, I was getting very alienated about AA here. In the last month, and it was crescendoing on the evening that I was asked to speak at this meeting, actually, where I was just feeling like, you know, ever since I moved to the East Bay, which was like 12 years ago, just hasn't really clicked, you know? I just don't feel like I don't know people, and, you know, I don't go out with people very much, and I've been raising kids, and some of these meetings are just, like, really clicky, and I fucking hate them, and, you know, and I was really kind of getting to this place, and I was talking to my wife about it, and we just started listing all the things that would have not happened if I hadn't been here doing this stuff, doing the steps, which is really, really boring when people enumerate the steps, and I'm not going to do that. But the thing is, it's all these things that are really contrary to what, to how I operate. And it made all these things possible. So the first time I did the steps, I ended up in Alaska. I've done AA in some really strange places. And I was in Wasilla, Alaska. That's where Sarah Palin's from. And the people up there are so bomber. Oh, God, they're wonderful. They live in trailers that have Christmas tree lights on them all year round. And they were telling me things like, you know, it ain't change that hurts, it's resistance. And just sit there. I had 9 months at that point. And at that point, I was still so socially phobic that I would go out with some people. My sister and her husband were rebuilding their house, and I was coming up there to help them. And what I'd come up to do was actually recharge the batteries on their cordless drills. And so I went to a lot of meetings. And so I'd go out with the guys who were working on this house, and we would go to a diner, and there'd be four of us, and there'd be a booth. And the three of them would get in that booth, and I would get in the next one, because I was just convinced that last seat was not for me. That I wasn't supposed to sit there for some reason. And these people in the meetings in Wasilla, they'd have me over. And these two old ladies who had hand-tooled leather big book covers. And they'd say, you know, you stick with me, son, I'm a crone. You know what a crone is? That's a wise old woman. And they'd take me over to their house where I would sit in the corner. And that was the best I could do at that point. That was really the best I could do. But there is a sensitive male in Wasilla, and he lives over by the lake, and he was my sponsor, and he was great. And he said, okay, you're not going to move here. You are not Alaska material. You are not going to move here. So, tell you what, why don't we do this? You're going to take all this shit that you're carrying around, and you're going to leave it here, like all the other tourists do. And then you're going to go home to the people you care about, right? And so that's what we're going to do. So we're going to do a four step. I was like, okay. So I did a four step, which was really difficult, and I really wanted to make it a novel, and I kept being told that it's not, you know, this is we're just dealing with our shit here, and this is, and it's very, very simple, and it's right there in the book. And we burned it on the banks of the Knick River, and I've been a really wonderful person since then. No, not really. since I achieved perfection, I've not found it necessary to drink or cut off old ladies on Highway 101, no, I've done that, definitely done that. Or be a terrible vandal in relationships, or just be a completely self-centered weirdo for years and years in sobriety. That's, you know, when they talk about the spiritual experience and how most of them are the educational variety, and that sucks, because I would love to be able to stick my finger in a light socket and know how to play the piano, you know, and be able to tell you guys and just like have it all together. But, it's never worked out that way. I learn in little ways over as time goes on. And I hate that. And I have to do it in front of y'all, which is even worse. If I could figure out a way to go do this in a cave somewhere and come back and be the Dalai fucking Lama, I would do it. But I can't. I have to do it with y'all. And the result is that, you know, I learn things over time. Like, I go on a date with somebody who's been to Harvard, and she spends the whole time going, "What are you talking about? What? What did you mean by that? What? What?" And so I went and I asked my sponsor about that, and he said, well, Gran, he's from Texas, Beauregard. Well, Gran, you're a bright boy, but you need an education. So I went to SF State, and I got a degree in music composition, which is really handy if you're going to be a cabinet maker, not really. But it was fun. I had a really good time. I was terminally, horribly single for like 6 years in sobriety. I was chewing my own limbs off. My God. And I called a sponsor, belly aching about that. This was the other one. This was the double-chinned gay Ubermensch sponsor in San Francisco, who said, "Well, okay, this is a one-day-at-a-time program, Gren, but let's just pretend you're never going to get laid again." How does that feel? Are you going to jump off a bridge now? Are you going to? No? Okay, then what are you going to do right now besides talk about this? Because I'm sick of hearing this. So I spent 4 years getting a music degree and figuring out what my favorite color was. And I took myself hiking for the first time. That was ridiculous. And I do it all the time now. But my first time hiking was like, oh God. And just doing all these like ridiculous things that, you know, wouldn't have occurred to me to do, because this program is actually here to set me free. It's not here to make me into anything but who I'm supposed to be. And so I did that, and then somehow I persuaded some poor lady to marry me. And that's the big practical joke, you know, being terminally single for 6 years, and now I've been married for almost 18 years. And how that happened. And that's another thing that AA has made possible, because there were so many times when I wanted to just vandalize that because a year had passed. And you really don't look like that 16-year-old that I was dating back in, you know, when I was 21. And that's really a deal breaker for me right now. I'm really disappointed. Really disappointed right now. And I really just wanted to, yeah. And, you know, and I wasn't the only one doing that, by the way. And I just really had this tendency to, you know, want to set people on fire when they started, you know, not meeting my expectations in some way, because that's what I do to myself on a daily basis. So I don't see why you're not, you know, consenting to be set on fire because you're not doing what I need you to do. And then God help us, we had kids. If you ever want to find out that it's not all about you, that's what you do. I did okay through, you know, the first one. Sleep training her was pretty hard. I'm not good without sleep now. The second one, when he came along, it was really hard. I actually turned into a big fat jerk, and I was not nice to my kids for a while. And had a lot of really bad episodes of like just really feeling shitty about myself, because of how I was acting, and not being able to turn it around, and finding myself in sobriety, like, you know, my wife's from England and we're visiting with her family in France, and I'm in France, I'm in Brittany. The beach is like, there's the water is liquid gold in Brittany, you know, and you walk out there and the water is like 70 degrees and it's just fantastic. And I just wanted to walk out there and never come back out. That's where I was at. And because I had to learn something, I had to learn something. And, I, had let myself coast a really long time, and I hadn't done a lot of work, and I hadn't been talking to people, and I hadn't been using the resources, and I'd got really alienated. And I knew I had to kind of do everything. And that's how I kind of address any illness, whether I have a backache or whether, or soul crushing despair, is, to hit it with everything. You never quite know what fixed it, but that's okay. And so, you know, that means, get a sponsor, do acupuncture, work the steps, do meditation, go see those nice people in the Episcopal Church. They're okay. Do all that. And it kind of culminated. I was, at this point, I'm a cabinet maker and I'm working in a shop in, thank you, perfect. In, I was going to say Germany, but it was in San Rafael. They were just the German. German cabinet shop, and they were just, they were hardcore, and if you screwed up anything at all, then they all had to gather around and fold their arms and talk about this mistake you'd made and how terrible it was, and didn't you see you were making a mistake? That was my favorite thing they would say. Didn't you see that you were making this mistake? And it was really, and I was just getting, I was going home every day just wanting to blow my brains out, and I was having trouble at home, and my kids were small and demanding. And so my boss called me in because I'd screwed up something on a very fine piece of furniture and I'd made it not so fine, and he wanted to talk to me about that. But I beat him to it. I jumped right in there and I told him just how abusive this workplace is and how abusive you people are. And I don't know what kind of apprenticeship bullshit you guys come from, but I am not having, you know, I'll eat shit for a mistake, but I am not going to, you know. And I remember the look on his face and how he just sat there and he listened to me for a long time. And then he said, "Grant, I don't know you very well, but don't you have some kind of spiritual thing you're doing?" And I said, well, don't change the subject. And we had this really awkward conversation. And then I went home and I told my wife, I remember, it was yesterday, she's doing the dishes. And she didn't even turn around. And I told her all about how, you know, he told me this, but I told him that. And she didn't even turn around. She said, okay, you need to call somebody. And it can't be that guy that blows sunshine up your ass, that guy. Don't talk to him. You need to call the cranky gay guy. The one who just blows you up. You need to talk to him. And I have nothing to say to you. She'd been married to me, you know, for 5 years, and she'd learned quick. So I made a phone call to somebody who said, so how's it going? You think you're better than they are? Is that, so it's kind of been a lot of that. It's been a lot of little things like that, that have kind of turned things around slowly. I don't know where I'm at now. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm starting to do music again. That's really weird. I'm still making cabinets. That's okay. My kids, who I could have easily really screwed up and like lost my marriage and lost them. My kids and I are really close. We're super close, and, this lady is still married to me, and when I think of all the times when I really wanted to throw her under the bus for whatever reason, and she me, there's something about being with somebody who's known you that long, and you know, just really working the acceptance with somebody, which doesn't mean like, oh, you're kind of stupid, but I accept you. It means that you're their strength and not their judge. And that's something I learned here. That is really not something I could have come up with on my own. That you're somebody's strength, that you make it happen. And that I'm not there to tell her how to make salad dressing or how to do dishes or whatever. But that's not important. I was there when my dad died. We hospiced my dad at home. That was incredible. He wanted some brandy. Gave him some brandy. Whatever, dude. And I'd always wanted him to say something nice to me sober, and he never quite was able to. And at one point, he'd had a major stroke, and he was just basically paralyzed. He was on his way out. And so we were washing him in bed and changing the bedding. And I rolled him over, and he was facing me, and I said, "Hi." And he just looked up and said, and I said, "You know, Dad, I've been needing you to say some things to me for quite a while, but I just, that I'll take that. That was great. Thank you." And now we're, looking after my mom, who's 85 and on Percocet and, a bit cranky, but I'm the one, you know, I'm the one in our family who's doing this, and I was the village idiot of my family. So the fact that this is happening, you know, I'm super busy. You know, I've got two kids in high school, who are starting to think they know stuff and need to be disabused of that regularly. And I've got a mom who every time I walk by says, "The light bulb's out," you know, or the bird feeder needs filling, or, you know, I can't walk by without something. And it's constant. It's absolutely constant, and it's beautiful. Every single thing in my life is, it's this blessing of being able to be there for people. Was that a pencil dropping?
Oh, no, I'm sorry. Okay. That was...
Well, drop my recorder at you. thank you. And the only thing that goes wrong is that big neon sign over my head that says, "What about me?" And I start turning around and looking at that sign, and I start thinking that it's about me again, and that I'm running this, and that I'm making crucial, important decisions about my life that need to be made right now, and are important so that I can have this life for me, mine, me, mine, me. And, what was taught to me here was to just not to get out of the driver's seat and not drive the bus. And it's actually a relief. It's actually a big relief to not be, trying to control all this. You guys are going to go home and talk about how stupid I am, and I have no control about that. You know, that's fine. That's just what you're going to do. And I can let go of that today. For me today, that's okay. And the last bit of really good news I got is that, you know, in the 11th step, just being able to take a minute and look at my mind, do all the stupid things it does. I was trying to hang out with some Zen people, and they talked about places of peace. And for me, it's like watching a knife fight for 20 minutes. And, you know what? You know what it's like? It's like being in a car and the doors are locked and you can't get out, and it's permanently going at 60 miles an hour, and you just have to dodge things. And there's a guy next to you, and he's reading the phone book really loud. That's what it's like. And, but through meditation, you can kind of sit next to that and go, "Whoa, you're weird. That thought, that was a bad thought. That's another bad thought. Wow, look, a whole bunch of them. There they go." And not, and I don't have to put a saddle on any one of those thoughts and ride it around. Do I do that? Sometimes, sure, all the time. But I am not my mind. Thank God for that. So for you new folks, this stuff works. Nothing else worked for me. And I don't understand spiritual solutions. I like liquids that you put in your body that feel warm and make you feel good. That's what I understand. And when people try to offer me a duck when I want a sandwich, I don't know about that. But it works. It really works. So keep coming back, and thanks for letting me do a service.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.